Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
First up this morning, it's a competition and one for you fans of Pink Floyd and the wonderful RTE Concert Orchestra. Next month is 40 years since the iconic album The Wall was first released, and to celebrate, the RTE Concert Orchestra and the band Visions of Floyd will be performing the album live and with brand new orchestral arrangements here at the National Concert Hall in Dublin on the 18th and 19th of November. One night's already sold out, the other selling fast. However, I have a pair of tickets to give away this morning for Tuesday, the 19th of November, along with bed and breakfast in the great four-star Ivy Garden Hotel. All you need to do to win this great prize is answer this very simple question. Pink Floyd sung that they didn't need know what? Was it education or more Brexit? Please text your answer with your name and address to 51551 and I'll let you know who's won by the end of today's show. We're going to start this morning with some beautiful live music. Well, Paul Noonan, as we know, is part of the super successful band Bell X1. But he first played music as a nine-year-old flautist in the Lucan Concert Band. He then went on to the band Juniper, formed while still at school, and then of course on to Bell X1, which has cemented his reputation for being one of our finest singer-songwriters. He's now about to embark on a number of solo appearances, one at Sligo Live, which we'll talk about in a while. But good morning, first of all, Paul. You're going to sing for us live?
I am.
What are you going to sing first?
I'm going to sing a song called Glacier.
Brilliant. Off you go.
Okay.
I will take you where you were. I will take you anywhere at all, no matter how absurd. That's just how I feel now. That's just how I feel now. Cause I like the sound of your words that fill the shiny covenant I copper to unfurl, that we might find our feet now, that we might plant our feet now. It's like you're a glacier, a glacier on the move, tearing up valleys and rivers, cutting out your groove. Tons of melt water, all that falling like sweet words from your mouth. Oh, it's like you're a glacier, a glacier on the moon. Yeah, I'm hanging on every word, but you're standing on my finger. Say that's just absurd. You say I'm being silly now, and that's always been my Achilles now. So I will renounce the world between this window ledge and the seabed, and I should have said I see your face retreating now, framed in blue sky. I don't really care.
will take you at your word. I will take you at your word. 16 tons of mild water, hard to fall in, like sweet
That was beautiful, Paul, singing and playing live for us, all on your own playing live, despite there's loads of instruments sounding here in our Studio 10. And of course, you're playing as part of Sligo Live at the Hawkswell Theatre next Saturday, the 26th of October. Tickets are on sale now from sligolive.ie and from the Hawkswell Theatre. But we'll talk much more about that when you come back at the end of the show.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for coming in, Paul. Well, we move on. The Chinese writer Yung Chang wrote the global bestseller Wild Swans about her family's torment during the Cultural Revolution. It remains the most read book about China and the most successful work of non-fiction ever published. Yung Chang is here in Dublin right now to talk about her latest book, Big Sister, Little Sister, Red Sister, which is all about three women. It's a biography about them at the heart of 20th century China. And great for me, Yung Chang is now in Studio 10 with me as well. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
Oh, it's my privilege that you're here. And I know later on today you're going to be interviewed at a free event as part of the Dublin Festival of History at 6 p.m. in Dublin Castle. Listen, if you don't mind, could we go back a little bit just for my listeners this morning? Many people will have read Wild Swans, but for those who haven't, tell me about the China you were born into, Yung.
Okay. I was born in 1952. It was under Mao, you know, the tyrant of China. When I was growing up, China was completely isolated from the outside world, and there was great terror. And when I loved writing when I was a child, but I didn't even dream of being a writer, because in those days, nearly all writers were condemned, you know, sent to the gulag, driven to suicide, or some were even executed. Even writing for oneself was dangerous. I wrote my first poem when I was 16. But then the Red Guards came to raid our flat, and I had to quickly go to the bathroom to tear up my poem and flush it down the toilet. So that ended my first venture. But the idea of writing never left me. In the following years, you know, I worked as a peasant and as a steel worker and an electrician. When I was spreading manure in the paddy fields, when I was checking electricity supplies on top of the electricity poles, now, I was always writing in my head with an imaginary pen, but I couldn't put pen to paper until many, many years later when I was in Britain.
And your mother, I think you were telling this, is a remarkable woman and was part of getting you to write even her story, wasn't it? Tell me about your mom. She's still alive and living in China still, I think.
Yes, she's 88. She's frail. She lives in Chengdu in China. My mother was the person who inspired me to write. For 10 years after I came to the West in 1978, I didn't want to write. Then my mother came to visit me in London in 1988. For the first time, she told me the stories of her life and stories of my grandmother, her relationship with my father. Once my mother started, she couldn't stop. She stayed with me for 6 months and she talked every day. When I was out working, she talked into a tape recorder. And then I realized that my mother seemed to know that I had this cherished but unspoken dream, and she was helping me to fulfill this dream because she left me 60 hours of tape recordings. And then that's how I wrote Wild Swans.
Did you ever imagine Wild Swans would be the extraordinary global success that it was as a book? Did you think it would be that successful?
No, and I didn't think how the this question didn't occur to me. This also thanks to my mother. When the book was finished, just before it was published, my mother wrote to me from China and said, the book might not do well and people might not pay attention to it, but I was not to worry, because she felt that writing the book had brought us closer together. Mm-hmm. She felt I loved her more and understood her more. And she said I had made her a happy woman. So I was completely without agony before the publication. And of course, it turned out to be a success. So it's quite wonderful.
A massive success. The only downside is that you can't see your, because your mother's in China, you're only allowed in because of your writing. Is it 15 days a year to visit her?
Yes. Well, and that's not just because of Wild Swans, but because of my other books as well. Because after I wrote Wild Swans, my Irish husband, my Dundalk born.
Up Dundalk.
Irish husband.
What's his name, actually?
John Halliday. We wrote a biography of Mao together. We spent 12 years of my life writing a biography of Mao. John actually had learned Russian when he was in Dundalk. Yes, and he worked in the Russian archives, which turned out to be a treasure trove. Together we traveled all over the world interviewing everyone who had the interesting dealings with Mao. We visited archives everywhere together, and we had a great time. Then we wrote this biography of Mao, but that was dynamite. Time magazine described it as an atom bomb of a book. And that book really brought the biggest trouble, which was I was nearly banned from going to China to visit my mother. And through the help of the British Foreign Office, I have been able to go back to China for 12 days, for 2 weeks a year, and to see my mother. And of course, I my mother is elderly, and I feel intensely anxious and sad when she is dangerously ill, and when I wish I could be with her, but I can't. And I live in dread that someday this privilege, so to speak, of visiting my mother might be revoked, so I may never see her again. My mother is very strong. She's, at 88, she's still a tower of strength for me. And we, of course, we realized that this is the price for writing my books honestly.
Now, your wonderful new book, which I wrote, called Big Sister, Little Sister, Red Sister, it's a biography, really, of these incredible three sisters who were at the heart of 20th century China. Tell my listeners about them.
Yes. Well, they are also three women. I mean, Wild Swans is about three women on the receiving end of history. And these three women were in the center of power, making history. One of them, Red Sister Qing Ling, married what is known as the father of China, of Republican China. She was a communist, and she went on to be Mao Zedong's vice chair. So she is in the center of the communist power. But her sisters were passionately anti-communist. Little sister Mei Ling married Chiang Kai-shek, the ruler of China before Mao, who was defeated by Mao and thrown to Taiwan. And big sister Ai Ling made herself one of the richest women in China. And these, these two sisters, also like the Red Sister, were sort of political figures in their own right. Mm. Mei Ling became, in her time during the Second World War, particularly, one of the most famous women in the world because of her act as a First Lady of wartime China.
Well, it sounds like it could actually be a movie of the three of them. I have to be honest, I didn't know anything about them. Is that terrible?
Well, in China, because history has been so much falsified and the true stories have been so difficult to generate, to write about. So many people naturally don't know anything about them. And a lot of people know about them, but know the myth about them. They were like fairy tale figures. There is the name. They were like princesses, but in the fairy tale land. I myself knew some things about them when I was in China, when I was growing in China. In those years, we live in great poverty, and milk was regarded as the most precious thing. But the average Chinese had no access to milk, which was only available to the elite. And so there was a rumor that Madame Chiang Kai-shek, little sister Mei Ling, every day bathed in milk. And that was why her skin was so fine. And this was supposed to make us feel outraged at the extravagance, unbelievable extravagance. And one of our teachers was trying to address this myth. And he said one day, "And do you really think bathing in milk is pleasant?" And of course, he was soon condemned as a rightist, which was one of the people, undesirable people in communist China.
Well, it's a great read. It's called Big Sister, Little Sister, Red Sister. It's published by Jonathan Cape. And as I said, you're going to be interviewed later today at a free event at the Dublin Festival of History at 6 p.m. in Dublin Castle. Just before I let you go, when you look at China today and what's happening in Hong Kong, are you as concerned as ever for your country?
I am very concerned. I also have a degree of optimism. I keep my fingers crossed that things will work out. I feel that, you know, of course, Hong Kong's fate is linked to that of mainland China. Mm. And China has been changing since Mao's death in 1976. And the door that has been opened can't be closed again. And the idea of liberty and people's experiences they can't be dragged back into Mao's time again. They can't wind the clock back again.
Okay, well, look, Yung Chang, continued success with all your great books. And thanks so much for coming to chat to us this morning in RT. We'll take a break. With me in studio now is Stephen Bradley. He's the director behind numerous really successful movies, including Noble, about the life of Christina Noble. But a couple of years ago, when he and his wife, the actor and multi-talented Deirdre O'Kane, returned from London to live back here, he discovered he had cancer. And his new memoir, called Shooting and Cutting, A Survivor's Guide to Filmmaking and Other Diseases, is just out. It's really interesting. It details his thoughts, his worries and his treatment. Stephen's with me now. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, Miriam.
I have to say, you're looking extremely healthy.
Thank you very much. That's a nice thing to hear.
Yeah. I love, of course, your dedication. I'm weird. The first thing I read in a book is always who it's dedicated to.
Right. And this is dedicated to my sister, who herself was a doctor, Dr. Fiona Bradley. And unfortunately, she died of cancer when she was 41 in 2002.
That changes families, doesn't it, when you lose a sibling young, do you think that?
Yeah, in a huge way. Mm. I mean, there's no getting around it, is there? There's the experience of going through the cancer treatment with them. And actually, she did very well. She had a very serious secondary, but actually survived for 2 years with it and enjoyed those 2 years. So we were able to enjoy them with her, and I would see her every day. And that was a privilege at the time, if an unfortunate privilege. But it changes everything for the whole family. And obviously, it's particularly hard for parents because one of their precious offspring is dying before they do.
Yeah. Now tell us about yourself, because as I said, you and Deirdre, super successful, made that movie Noble. Everything trucks along fine, I suppose, in the busy lives everyone leads. When did you notice you didn't feel well? I mean...
Well, we moved back from London at the beginning of 2016 very quickly because we'd been offered school places for our kids, and that was, Holly was going into secondary school, and that was, for so many families, I think, coming back, that's the moment you go. So we moved within, we made the decision and moved within about 6 weeks. I'd just finished a writing job, so I thought I was tired from that. Then I was packing up the house on my own because Deirdre was off doing a job. Then we did the move. Then Deirdre was presenting the IFTAs, actually, and they suddenly went, we need comedy sketches for the opening sequence, etc. Can you do that? So I had to do that. And as Deirdre said, I was a bit grumpy during that time. And then my other sister, Susie, said, you know, we'd been back 3 weeks. She said, you just look terrible. Go and see a doctor. And that was the beginning of a fairly horrendous journey.
So, but I assume like most people, you go along to the doctor thinking, I'm fine. Or did you have any sense that you mightn't be fine?
In retrospect, I probably did, although I had been for a full checkup about 3 years previously for... bowel cancer, actually, which is what I ended up getting, and that was an all clear. So I sort of wasn't on that. Something serious wasn't on my mind. And when I first went into A&E, they were talking about liver infections and possibly diverticulitis and fairly minor things compared to what I ended up with. But you know, in retrospect, I probably had that dread. And I went to a brilliant GP. It was the first time I'd ever met him, and he said to me, listen, I could give you antibiotics for a week or something like that, but actually you need to go straight to A&E and I'm going to give you a letter. And that was very shocking. And I suddenly thought, okay, this isn't good.
And that moment when someone told you you had cancer, is that etched in your mind or not?
It is, because we had a slightly unfortunate experience where I have this amazing group of doctors now, six consultants in all, and many brilliant nurses. And we had a slightly unfortunate experience where they were doing all the tests, and it came to the weekend, and they'd put me in this great room to give myself and Deirdre some privacy. And unfortunately, another doctor outside the team decided that we should know that I had bowel cancer. And I describe it in the book. It's the one, it's one of the negative, the few negative things that happened to me in the HSE. But I have to describe it because it was sort of our darkest hour. And I suppose I knew I had a shadow on my liver at that point. And now I was being told I had bowel cancer. And then I thought, listen, this must be everywhere.
And it was abruptly told, wasn't it? For someone who hasn't yet read your book.
Yeah, it was unfortunately abruptly told on a Friday evening when we didn't have access to the rest of my medical team. And so we spent the weekend not having any answers. And that was, as I say, the worst time and the darkest time. And it was a very tough beginning. And then back into the hospital after the weekend, and I started meeting the succession of brilliant consultants. And once they told us that I had hope, I had a long journey to go on, but I had hope, then we could knuckle down to just the visceral experience of going through the treatment. And, you know, they have been an incredible team of doctors and medics and nurses, and that's all on the public health system here, which I wasn't expecting, to be honest.
Because originally, so your diagnosis was a stage 4 bowel cancer,
is that
right?
I wasn't told that at the time because I didn't want to know. I sort of knew I was very ill, and I didn't ask any, I never have asked for statistics or life expectancy or any of that. That's just not my thing, because I want to try and treat myself as an individual and get through it as best that I can get through it. I was told later, obviously, that I had stage 4, and for example, my blood levels, tumour levels in my blood, where I think they're normally 0.5 to 7 or something, and mine were 1,300.
Okay.
So, you know, they knew I was incredibly ill.
It's interesting you say that about the consultancy. I mean, I'm reading your book, it's like, because I think even, for instance, in prime time, we're always doing stories where the health service is in crisis. But when you're very ill in this country, like you were, they're all angels. I mean, they're like superheroes, aren't they? The way they treat you and make you better.
Yeah, I mean, I never want to undermine the fact that many people are struggling with the deficiency of the HSE and many people are struggling with their cancer treatment as we speak. But for me, and part of the reason for telling the story, I suppose, is that it has just been extraordinarily positive in the way that they have treated me, the way that they have all coordinated the treatment together, the way that they sort of design a thing for you specifically as an individual, whereas I think in a lot of countries you go into a protocol for what you've got and that's pretty much it. Whereas they have really taken a lot of care and you know, they seem to me to have got it right at every stage as well. And although it has been very tough, you know, they seem to have made the right sequence of decisions. And it was a complicated sequence. I went through about 16 different stages of treatment.
That's a lot.
It was a lot. I mean, for the first year, I was just in treatment full time with two huge surgeries and two sequences of chemotherapy and a new cutting edge monoclonal antibody called Cerbitux, which I discovered I wouldn't have got if I'd been in the NHS in the UK, but I got here. It's a very expensive drug.
Do they come under the body of what they call immunotherapy drugs or not?
There's a little bit of debate about whether it's precisely an immunotherapy drug or I think they're called targeted therapies. In other words, they target yours. And I was lucky because I tested, I had a gene called the wild type gene, which only I think a third of people have, and that was the appropriate gene for this treatment. So I think it's more accurately called a targeted treatment, and I think what it does is it locks onto the cancer cells and sort of stops them from dividing, is my layman's version of describing it.
Are you a different person pre and post your cancer? I mean, obviously, your whole career was a very successful director, but is Stephen Bradley sitting opposite me now? Do you look at life differently? I know people often ask that, but do you look at life differently?
I have to look at life differently because I am a cancer patient and I will be a cancer patient for the rest of my days. I have to deal with what they call scanxiety, the anxiety that comes with scans. And, you know, that's every 3 to 6 months. And so I sort of live season to season, if you like, and scan to scan. But that's okay. You know, I'm very positive about it. And because my medics are so amazing and there are more treatments coming on stream, et cetera, that, I don't let that worry me. You know, I'm in a good place now. But it's changed me. You know, I don't think I have a day that goes past when I'm not thinking about cancer.
Does it make you value things more in life or not?
You know, definitely. Yeah. I mean, Deirdre and I were both saying we've got to a stage now where we're back. You know, my energy is right up there. I'm working full time. We're working together on a new show for Sky and we're enjoying life and we're making sure that we enjoy life, you know. And sometimes Deirdre will turn around to me and say, you know, we've got to do something more joyous than this. We've got to, you know, let's book another plane trip or something like that, you know. So we're good at that. And obviously we're enjoying the kids as much as we can and all those simple things. And sometimes I think, well, I find myself sweating the small stuff, which you're not meant to do. I sometimes think, well, I'm sweating the small stuff, you know, I must be in a good place now.
And I noticed at the end of your book, something I find very interesting. You were talking about Mairis Houston, who's the Irish Times health correspondent, I think, about that very interesting thing about, like, there'll be people listening this morning, Stephen, who are going through cancer treatment. But the language around it about fighting, battling, a lot of people who have cancer don't like that language because it's like, oh, well, if you don't make it, it's because you haven't bothered to fight enough. And you address that really interestingly.
Yeah, there are a lot of coincidences that I talk about in the book. It's one of the themes of it. And one of the coincidences was just as I came to the end of writing the book, I came across this article by Mairis Houston, who ironically was a very good friend of Fiona's, my late sister. And he'd written this article about a survey that happened in the UK about this very thing, that the language of cancer and this fighting talk and all of that, that it works for some patients and they embrace it, but for others it's kind of oppressive and it makes them feel like a failure if their treatment doesn't go well. And he was just asking us to consider the language that we use for all cancer patients before we use it. And then I reviewed the book. I was, you know, proofreading the book and I realized that I had talked all the way through about fighting and battle and war and this. And part of it was that a friend of mine called Packy Smith had given me this beautiful oil painting on my first day of chemotherapy. And he said, when I was painting it, I realized it was you. And the painting is called The Fighting Man. Right. So that sort of, you know, it was a theme for me. And obviously the language worked for me because I subconsciously had used it all the way through the book. But I think it's really important, and I take Mairis's point, that, you know, we need to consider the language we use and use the language appropriate to each patient.
And before I let you go, and it is a really important read, I think, especially not just for anyone who's going through cancer, but just generally even Balmy's It's Fun, It's Called Shooting and Cutting, A Survivor's Guide to Filmmaking and Other Diseases, a memoir by Stephen Braddy, and it's published by Mercier Press. Final word, if there's someone who's listening this morning, Stephen, who might be going through cancer treatment, give them advice.
I think use the supports around you as much as possible if you can, your families and the medics around you. Try and keep a sense of humour because that helps, and stay positive. I mean, I think the mental health part of it is difficult but really important. So if you can stay positive, that's a huge boost. And the sense of humour, everywhere you go in the medical system, you find people with gallows humour, and it's part of the healing process, I think.
Okay, well, Stephen Braddy, delighted to see you doing so well and so healthy. Thanks so much for coming into us this morning. We'll take a break. With me in studio now is Stephen Braddy. He's the director behind numerous really successful movies, including Noble, about the life of Christina Noble. But a couple of years ago, when he and his wife, the actor and multi-talented Deirdre O'Kane, returned from London to live back here, he discovered he had cancer. And his new memoir, called Shooting and Cutting, A Survivor's Guide to Filmmaking and Other Diseases, is just out. It's really interesting. It details his thoughts, his worries and his treatment. Stephen's with me now. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, Miriam.
I have to say you're looking extremely healthy.
Thank you very much. That's a nice thing to hear.
Yeah. I love, of course, your dedication. I'm weird. The first thing I read in a book is always who it's dedicated to.
Right. And this is dedicated to my sister, who herself was a doctor, Dr. Fiona Braddy. And unfortunately, she died of cancer when she was 41 in 2002.
That changes families, doesn't it, when you lose a sibling young, do you think that?
Yeah, in a huge way. Mm. I mean, there's no getting around it, is there? There's the experience of going through the cancer treatment with them. And actually, she did very well. She had a very serious secondary, but actually survived for 2 years with it and enjoyed those 2 years. So we were able to enjoy them with her, and I would see her every day. And that was a privilege at the time, if an unfortunate privilege. But it changes everything for the whole family. And obviously, it's particularly hard for parents because one of their precious offspring is dying before they do.
Yeah. Now, tell us about yourself, because as I said, you and Deirdre are super successful, made that movie Noble. Everything trucks along fine, I suppose, in the busy lives everyone leads. When did you notice you didn't feel well? I mean,
well, we moved back from London at the beginning of 2016 very quickly because we'd been offered school places for our kids, and that was Holly was going into secondary school, and that was for so many families, I think, coming back, that's the moment you go. So we made the decision and moved within about 6 weeks. I'd just finished a writing job, so I thought I was tired from that. Then I was packing up the house on my own because Deirdre was off doing a job. Then we did the move. Then Deirdre was presenting the IFTAs, actually, and they suddenly went, we need comedy sketches for the opening sequence, etc. Can you do that? So I had to do that. And as Deirdre said, I was a bit grumpy during that time. And then my other sister, Susie, said, you know, we'd been back 3 weeks. She said, you just look terrible. Go and see a doctor. And that was the beginning of a fairly horrendous journey.
So, but I seem like most would you go along to the doctor thinking, I'm fine. Or did you have any sense that you mightn't be fine?
In retrospect, I probably did, although I had been for a full checkup about 3 years previously for bowel cancer, actually, which is what I ended up getting, and that was an all clear. So I sort of wasn't on that. Something serious wasn't on my mind. And when I first went into A&E, they were talking about liver infections and possibly diverticulitis and fairly minor things compared to what I ended up with. But you know, in retrospect, I probably had that dread. And I went to a brilliant GP. It was the first time I'd ever met him, and he said to me, listen, I could give you antibiotics for a week or something like that, but actually you need to go straight to A&E and I'm going to give you a letter. And that was very shocking. And I suddenly thought, okay, this isn't good.
And that moment when someone told you you had cancer, is that etched in your mind or not?
It is, because we had a slightly unfortunate experience where I have this amazing group of doctors now, six consultants in all, and many brilliant nurses. And we had a slightly unfortunate experience where they were doing all the tests, and it came to the weekend, and they'd put me in this great room to give myself and Deirdre some privacy. And unfortunately, another doctor outside the team decided that we should know that I had bowel cancer. And I describe it in the book. It's the it's one of the few negative things that happened to me in the HSE. But I have to describe it because it was sort of our darkest hour. And I suppose I knew I had a shadow on my liver at that point. And now I was being told I had bowel cancer. And then I thought, listen, this must be everywhere.
And it was abruptly told, wasn't it? For someone who hasn't yet read your book.
Yeah, it was unfortunately abruptly told on a Friday evening when we didn't have access to the rest of my medical team. And so we spent the weekend not having any answers. And that was, as I say, the worst time and the darkest time. And it was a very tough beginning. And then back into the hospital after the weekend, and I started meeting the succession of brilliant consultants. And once they told us that I had hope, I had a long journey to go on, but I had hope, then we could knuckle down to just the visceral experience of going through the treatment. And, you know, they have been an incredible team of doctors and medics and nurses, and that's all on the public health system here, which I wasn't expecting, to be honest.
Because originally, so your diagnosis was a stage 4 bowel cancer,
is that
right?
I wasn't told that at the time because I didn't want to know. I sort of knew I was very ill, and I didn't ask any, I never have asked for statistics or life expectancy or any of that. That's just not my thing because I want to try and treat myself as an individual and get through it as best that I can get through it. I was told later, obviously, that I had stage 4 and, for example, my blood levels, tumour levels in my blood, where I think they're normally 0.5 to 7 or something, and mine were 1,300.
Okay.
So, you know, they knew I was incredibly ill.
It's interesting you say that about the consultancy. I mean, I'm reading your book, it's like, because I think even, for instance, in prime time, we're always doing stories where the health service is in crisis. But when you're very ill in this country, like you were, they're all angels. I mean, they're like superheroes, aren't they? The way they treat you and make you better.
Yeah, I mean, I never want to undermine the fact that many people are struggling with the deficiency of the HSE and many people are struggling with their cancer treatment as we speak. But for me, and part of the reason for telling the story, I suppose, is that it has just been extraordinarily positive in the way that they have treated me, the way that they have all coordinated the treatment together, the way that they sort of design a thing for you specifically as an individual. Whereas I think in a lot of countries, you go into a protocol for what you've got and that's pretty much it. Whereas they have really taken a lot of care. And you know, they seem to me to have got it right at every stage as well. And although it has been very tough, you know, they seem to have made the right sequence of decisions. And it was a complicated sequence. I went through about 16 different stages of treatment.
That's a lot.
It was a lot. I mean, for the first year, I was just in treatment full time with two huge surgeries and two sequences of chemotherapy and a new cutting edge monoclonal antibody called Cerbitux, which I discovered I wouldn't have got if I'd been in the NHS in the UK, but I got here. It's a very expensive drug.
Do they come under the body of what they call immunotherapy drugs or not?
There's a little bit of debate about whether it's precisely an immunotherapy drug or I think they're called targeted therapies. In other words, they target yours. And I was lucky because I tested, I had a gene called the wild type gene, which only I think a third of people have. And that was the appropriate gene for this treatment. So I think it's more accurately called a targeted treatment, and I think what it does is it locks onto the cancer cells and sort of stops them from dividing, is my layman's version of describing it.
Are you a different person pre and post your cancer? I mean, obviously, your whole career was a very successful director, but is Stephen Bradley sitting opposite me now? Do you look at life differently? I know people often ask that, but do you look at life differently?
I have to look at life differently because I am a cancer patient and I will be a cancer patient for the rest of my days. I have to deal with what they call scansiety, the anxiety that comes with scans. And, you know, that's every 3 to 6 months. And so I sort of live season to season, if you like, and scan to scan. But that's okay. You know, I'm very positive about it. And because my medics are so amazing and there are more treatments coming on stream, etc., that I don't let that worry me. You know, I'm in a good place now. But it's changed me. You know, I don't think I have a day that goes past when I'm not thinking about cancer.
Does it make you value things more in life or not?
You know, definitely. Yeah. I mean, Deirdre and I were both saying we've got to a stage now where we're back. you know, my energy is right up there. I'm working full time. We're working together on a new show for Sky, and we're enjoying life, and we're making sure that we enjoy life, you know. And sometimes Deirdre will turn around to me and say, you know, we've got to do something more joyous than this. We've got to, you know, let's book another plane trip or something like that, you know. So we're good at that, and obviously we're enjoying the kids as much as we can, and all those simple things. And sometimes I think, well, I find myself sweating the small stuff, which you're not meant to do. I sometimes think, well, I'm sweating the small stuff, you know, I must be in a good place now.
And I noticed at the end of your book something I find very interesting. You were talking about Maoirse Houston, who's the Irish Times health correspondent, I think, about that very interesting thing about, like, there'll be people listening this morning, Stephen, who are going through cancer treatment. But the language around it about fighting, battling, a lot of people who have cancer don't like that language because it's like, oh, well, if you don't make it, it's because you haven't bothered to fight enough. And you address that really interestingly.
Yeah, there are a lot of coincidences that I talk about in the book. It's one of the themes of it. And one of the coincidences was just as I came to the end of writing the book, I came across this article by Maoirse Houston, who ironically was a very good friend of Fiona's, my late sister. And he'd written this article about a survey that happened in the UK about this very thing, that the language of cancer and this fighting talk and all of that, that it works for some patients and they embrace it, but for others it's kind of oppressive and it makes them feel like a failure if their treatment doesn't go well. And he was just asking us to consider the language that we use for all cancer patients before we use it. And then I reviewed the book. I was, you know, proofreading the book, and I realized that I had talked all the way through about fighting and battle and war and this. And part of it was that a friend of mine called Packy Smith had given me this beautiful oil painting on my first day of chemotherapy. And he said, when I was painting it, I realized it was you. And the painting is called The Fighting Man. Right. So that sort of, you know, it was a theme for me. And obviously the language worked for me because I subconsciously had used it all the way through the book. But I think it's really important, and I take Maoirse's point that, you know, we need to consider the language we use and use the language appropriate to each patient.
And before I let you go, and it is a really important read, I think, especially not just for anyone who's going through cancer, but just generally even families. It's fun. It's called Shooting and Cutting, A Survivor's Guide to Filmmaking and Other Diseases, a memoir by Stephen Braddy, and it's published by Mercier Press. Final word, if for someone who's listening this morning, Stephen, who might be going through cancer treatment, give them advice.
I think use the supports around you as much as possible if you can, your families and the medics around you. Try and keep a sense of humour because that helps, and stay positive. I mean, I think the mental health part of it is difficult but really important. So if you can stay positive, that's a huge boost. And the sense of humour, everywhere you go in the medical system, you find people with gallows humour, and it's part of the healing process, I think.
Okay, well, Stephen Braddy, delighted to see you doing so well and
Thank you.
So healthy. Thanks so much for coming into us this morning. We'll take a break.
Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Del dog food isn't all it's cracked up to be, let me tell you. I wouldn't mind, but this lot have saved themselves a right few quid by going online and getting the best possible price on AA car insurance. Surely they can afford a couple of goujons for yours truly. I don't have to have steak every day. Tuesdays and Thursdays is fine.
If you want the lowest AA car insurance price available, you'll find it online. Go to the AA.ie. Who's got clever car insurance? Acceptance criteria, terms and conditions apply. AA Ireland Limited Trading as AA Insurance is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland.
There's scarily good savings this week at Tesco. Like selected Halloween tubs, now €5. And a range of fun-sized bags like Mars, Maltesers and Milky Way, any three for €5. Start carving pumpkins from just €1. Or pick up a bag of monkey nuts or a coconut, 49 cent each. Shop in store or online. Tesco, every little helps.
The Ray D'Arcy Show, weekdays from 3 on RTE Radio 1.
On the line is Dame Julie Andrews. Hello.
Hello, Ray.
Did you spell it backwards or sing it backwards?
I said it backwards. But my then husband Tony said, why don't you try saying it backwards? I can still do it, and it's gotten me past many a young child on the street who says, I can say Super Cow. I said, yeah, but can you say it backwards?
Well, you know you're going to have to do it now, Julie Andrews.
Yeah.
Yes.
I can do it.
Okay.
Dosha Sally Expiastic Fragicali Rupus.
It works brilliantly.
The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. the largest Irish-owned pharmacy brand, who recently welcomed 17 new pharmacies to the AllCare family.
Tweet at Miriam O'Cal. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
And our text number is 51551. Only time for one text, just to say, lovely positive story there from Stephen. 10 years ago, my partner had leukemia, and following chemotherapy, he had to have bone marrow transplant. He ran his first marathon last October, and he's ready to run another next Sunday. So, great hope there. Well, look, in the late 1990s, John Kenny and his partner and close friend Pat Short redefined Irish comedy. The Dumbelievables were the biggest show in town, and the two toured the country playing the biggest venues and getting the largest laughs. But it was only when John and Pat went their separate ways did we all realise what fine actors they both are. And John, who's with me now, is currently in The Matchmaker, which is back at the Gaiety for the last week, as well as touring with his own super successful one-man show, Crowman. Good morning, John Kenny.
Morning, Miriam.
What are you doing to your shirt?
Taking a little bit of egg off my shirt. I'm just glad of seeing it. What the thing with egg, you know, that the bit of the yolk.
Yes.
Yeah, it's great. I like eggs, actually.
I love eggs.
Eggs are great, yeah.
Now, listen, you are from Lough Gur, and you came up to me this morning from Lough Gur.
Yeah.
Where is Lough Gur, and tell me about it.
Lough Gur is in... It's southeast Limerick. It's probably part of Ireland that's a little bit underdiscovered. It's not on the great tourist trail, but we get quite a few visitors, and especially to Lough Gur and that area up around the Ballyhoras. And it's southeast Limerick. And I think, well, for me, Lough Gur is, it's great. It's a great community. Lovely community there, and an amazing area, a great place. I suppose Lough Gur, for me, has its own energy and has its own magic. I often say that, and because for me it's a landscape full of magic, because Lough Gur is probably one of the oldest known settlements of us species of humans, mankind that we have in Ireland, and it goes right back to Neolithic times and brings us right up this. As the late Michael Quinlan used to say, who was a local historian and archaeologist, he said, from every time in history, there's something from every time in history in Lough Gur, and still there, from every time in history. So you could go and you could follow the story of civilization down in Lough Gur without ever leaving it. That's how magical Lough Gur is.
And you grew up there. Tell me about your background and your mum and dad.
I grew up in Hospital, which is a village about... it's probably about seven, I was going to say miles, kilometres. I do everything is time with me now. I never do miles or distances. It's always a half an hour, 3 hours, a 5 hour drive. So it's about 10 minutes drive from a place called Hospital, which Hospital has its own history as well. Hospital originally was known as Glan Oinne, which is beside Cnoc Oinne, which is the hill of Van, of course, and Hospital was Glan Oinne, but found the name Hospital because there were Knights Templars that set up. The hospital, Knights Templars set up in Hospital in Glan Oinne in 12-something, around middle of 12.
You should have been the historian.
So, yeah, there's a lot of history around the whole area. Like, you're connected with Cnoc Oinne, the Hill of Ann and everything like that. And there's a load of legend and history. And that's where I grew up, was in Hospital, in the village of Hospital. My mum ran a shop there. She was in the rag trade. She ran and she wasn't always in the rag trade, but after my father died, my dad passed away when we were young, and he was in the rag trade, and we had a pub as well, a business, and my mother didn't like the pub at all. She hated it, actually. So the one thing she wanted to do, and my dad died when we were all quite young. I was only 4, and Deirdre, the youngest of us, was about 1.5, and the rest of the siblings, Anne was the oldest. She would have been about 9, I'd say, or probably 10. So man was left with 5 of us in County Limerick, and she didn't drive with no transport. And so Hospital became, she set her roots down in Hospital, originally from the west of Ireland. Both my parents were from the west and had moved to County Limerick via London, because they got married in London before the war, and or after the war, actually, and then came back to Ireland. And he wasn't long in Ireland when he passed away. He died of a brain hemorrhage.
God, last week I was interviewing some people as well.
Yeah.
A is so hard. Oh, just such rotten luck for your mom and for your dad. But you were 4. Have you any memory of your father?
I have 2 vague memories of him, and they're all very, I don't know whether they're real or just imaginary, but they're always lovely, warm memories. One is around because we had the bar at the time. He had bought a pub, and It wasn't that he wanted to be a publican. I don't know why he bought a pub. He was a good businessman as well, I suppose. But I remember just being in a bar with him and being... I actually wrote a song about it last year. I was writing stuff and it came out of me. I wasn't wanting to write songs at all, but this song came out about being left alone. And it was actually about that time. I had this vivid memory of being left alone at the back of the house when the rest of them went off. The rest of my... we'll say the older ones in the family, the other three... And a few of their friends went off and left me in the yard after promising me they'd take me with them. And I think they were going off down the fields or something out the back of the village. And for some reason, I located it around St. Patrick's Day as if they were going off as kids to pick shamrock and they didn't bring me. And I remember just being left alone inside in the yard, inside in this yard on my own, and they had gone off and left me and they didn't bring me. And I wrote this song. It was about that. And that's one of the memories I have of him bringing me into the bar and sitting me up on a stool. What? And I remember feeling that I was up on a... that the stool was huge. I could have fallen off. I was up on this awful height of a thing. And he gave me a glass of lemonade.
That's a lovely memory.
That is a lovely memory. Yeah. And the other one I have him then is coming in. And I think it's him dressed up as Santa. I remember seeing Santa as a young fella. But my mum told me later on he used to borrow a Santa Claus outfit and he'd go around the house just in case any kids woke up at Christmas and Christmas Eve dressed up as Santa and he'd place presents around the place, you know. So there are my two memories of him. So.
Do you ever think back now, I mean, to lose any parent and to lose your dad so young, that without you knowing it when you're four.
Yeah.
But as you get older, do you think that was probably a very formative experience to lose your dad so young?
Oh, yeah, I'd say I definitely was and definitely shaped a lot maybe of what goes on in my head because I obviously grew up in a house then with like three sisters and my mother. And it was a great house. And I suppose I learned a lot about female life and about womanhood because it was a female house basically. Myself and my brother lived there and dominated by females. But that was good, I think. That was a good thing for me to experience. And I remember then at one stage, I think my brother saying to me, you're always looking for a father figure. And probably I was without knowing it, that I'd always found my way to people in life, adult men. I was people that were different. I was drawn towards them.
Yeah.
And I suppose I befriended people a lot, like, you know, more so. I wasn't one to kind of sit back in the corner. I kind of wanted to make contact with people and communicate with people and see what they were at. That was always a thing that I had going on in my life. And that happened an awful lot with men, I suppose.
Yeah.
You know, even friends of mine and their parents, I'd connect with their fathers or their grandfathers even. Maybe I was looking for something. Of course, obviously. I mean, you do something, you go look for it. It's a natural thing that you do. But I think that it was a good thing because it opened up another window, another door for me, another way of looking at things that I suppose I was lucky to experience, like that whole idea of my mother trying to run a family and to run a business and knowing her struggles as a woman when I was growing up back in the 60s. I just remember her saying to me one time, like, well, it wasn't not one time, but it was like a repeated sort of mantra that she never gave out or complained much, but she'd come down after being at the bank above in the village and she'd just walk in the door and you knew by her she was upset, but not, you know, not hugely upset, but she was, you know, and she'd shake her head and she'd say, if there was a man in the house, they wouldn't do that. And that was the mantra. If there was a man in the house, they wouldn't do that. Because she was a woman in business, you know. And I think there was an empathy that I felt for her and for women because I could understand it from her point of view. I suppose I grew up with it. That it wasn't easy for women going into banks even back then, trying to run a business, looking for overdrafts, rearing a family. Men wore suits and men were in control, you know. And I suppose I've really always balked about that, from that a little bit. I've always gone the opposite. Do you know, here's me at 60. I bought a bracelet a few weeks ago. What's that?
Lovely bracelet.
Isn't that
I'm
a
looking
nice
at
bracelet,
it.
You know?
But didn't your mother love music as well?
Oh, she did. She did.
That she used to play the kind of musicals.
All the musicals. I mean, we were reared in them. And I think for dad and mum, when they were living their life together in probably the best part of their life, they lived it in London because even before they were married and... You know, they were going out then, so there was no kids. And they obviously went to musicals and they went to dances and they went to hear the big bands and the jazz, stuff they wouldn't have heard here. It was like, although it was probably, before the war and after the war, it was an amazing romantic time because all the songs are romantic, and maybe it's because people didn't know what was going on. There was a sense of we must enjoy the moment now, this sort of outflowing of emotion, expression of sexuality, of just all this stuff. And the music had all that, and I loved all that music from that period and still do.
Which is great.
Because she had all those classic jazz numbers and old musical songs and music from the big bands, and it was a magical era. Like, I don't think it's ever been repeated within the world of music, and probably never will be.
And earlier on, of course, you were talking about language and dialect. You know so much about it. I mean, it must be a joy. At the moment, of course, you're starring in The Matchmaker, which is, of course, based on the great John B. Keane's novel, Letters of a Country Matchmaker. Yeah. He's still so popular, but of course, it's a lot to do with the language he used as well, isn't it, John?
Well, I must say, I'm probably biased because I love his language. And to me, it's very... There's a poetry in it, you know. There's real, to me, there's a poetry in it, and I love. And then it's very close to me as well, because that West Limerick, North Kerry accent, there's very little between it. Like, you're just a hint away, like, and you're over the border and you're there. And there's a little sing in something, there's a wisp in something, but you wouldn't rush to Kerry man either, not a West Limerick man. If a West Limerick man was telling you anything, you'd think twice about it. Because the whore would be up to something, like, you know what I mean? He wouldn't... There might be something behind it, like, you know? But he does capture this kind of... It's like a Welsh... This kind of... It's in the dialect, and Keane does it beautifully. Like, and I mean, I was thinking today on the way up, like, near the end of The Matchmaker...
Do something.
When he designs... Yeah. When he realises that he's on his own, a man who's been putting people together all their life so they wouldn't be lonely, he ends up lonely himself, and it's the last letter in the piece where he writes to his sister who's in America, and he says, looking out the window the other evening before I sat down to the supper, I noticed the light failing in the sky, and I saw the first mists of the winter settling on the shoulders of the hills. As far as the eye could sweep, there was nothing to be seen save the smoke from Cud Muldoon's chimney or a straggle of pensioner crows and their flapping home to Parson Robinson's rookery. God be good to them. In no time at all, it was dark. And the strangest feeling came over me. As if I was the only creature in this whole wide world. My dog lay sleeping like a top in the corner. And the cat, he took off hunting the minute the moon shone bright. There was no cold in the kitchen as... I had the fire bright and it was well banked, but for all that, a shiver ran through me like I can't explain to you. I never felt so alone. I'd never felt like this before, and I guess that it was the jostling between the tug of life or the tug of the grave. But it was fear, Marge. It was fear. A man's fear. A man's fear in his lonesome state. There is no lone man proof against that fear. For I felt like going to my bed and pulling the covers over my head. But when I heard the sound that was more welcome than the dews of the morning... And that's when he is Lila McGee. But it's very...
Can I just say for my listeners, you just ad-libbed all of that. You're not reading any of that.
No, beautiful. And I didn't do it right either. I just came in.
No, it's absolutely beautiful. Wanted to mention Crowman, and I know that's written by Katie Holly from Charleville, who's won many awards for it. You play about, is it 10 different characters in that?
A lot in Crowman, yeah. And it's lovely. It's lovely to play this range of characters that she has written. And I suppose you play the whole village and his whole family, so that's probably more than 10, that's 15. And it's his journey and it's Dan's journey. It's a beautiful, simple story about just a guy who's, you know, he finds himself a little bit, as time goes by, he thinks he's on his own. But it's a story of community, and it's very uplifting because you suddenly realise you're really not on your own, you know.
No,
there's someone there for you, you know.
So. Listen, Liz texts and say, John, will you ever repeat your Dylan Thomas one-man show, It's Magic?
God, yeah. Under Milkwood, yeah.
Yeah,
well,
so anyway.
We did that a few years ago.
And another Bernie says, best wishes to John. I was having chemo in early 2000, around the same time as John, from one survivor to another. Hi, John, and aren't we all great? So that's great.
You.
So listen, just I want to say, because Paul Noonan wonderfully has come back into studio and is going to sing for us, but in relation to you, John, the Matchmakers at the Gaiety Theatre for 1 week only from the 4th of November.
Yeah.
Tickets from Ticketmaster.ie or from thegaietytheatre.ie.
Yeah.
And Crowman by Katie Holly is touring the whole country the rest of the month in November.
Yeah.
From Moat to Galway to Bray to Thurles. And for more information, your website, johnkenny.net.
Yeah.
And there's no H in your John, johnkenny.net. Paul Noonan, welcome back. As I said earlier, part of Bell X1, but also about to do loads of solo shows. You're heading, of course, to Sligo Live, Paul. Do you love, I know you're part of Bell X1, but do you enjoy playing alone as well?
It's always been a great chance to play new songs. I've always found, like, there's, I can play them in wherever I write them and it can be a thing, but then you don't playing to live humans is the testing ground, really, is when you feel like if there's a connection or not.
And of course Sligo Live has been so successful. I think here it has extended to 11 days from the 18th to the 28th of October. It's gone for 15 years, got a great lineup with the Coronas, Jules Holland, John Bishop, the Indigo Girls, yourself. You're playing the Hawkswell Theatre, aren't you, next Saturday, the 26th of October?
Yeah. And the night before, I'm playing Westival in Westport in the Holy Trinity Church, which is a beautiful church there in Westport, yeah.
You write beautiful songs, like you sang one for us earlier, you're going to sing one for us now. Do you write the music and words, lyrics at the same time? I'm always interested. Do you write them separately? Which comes first?
I would sort of have snippets of paper hanging out in my arse pocket and bits of recordings on my phone that I wake up in the middle of the night and record, and then when it comes to fashioning songs, I look at all these things and I cobble them together or use one as a springboard for the song. Yeah.
And when you're playing in a band with Bell X1, there's a lot of camaraderie. Is it lonelier when you go out on your own?
I remember because I was a drummer, you know, a drummer with notions. So I remember coming out from behind
and a beautiful voice.
Coming out from behind the kit, I definitely felt naked and very vulnerable for a while. You know, there were no drums to hide behind, and this is another level of that. I'm finding it's sort of, but I'm loving playing to, you know, playing these small theatre shows and with just the guitar and the piano and feeling that connection. You know,
because you're here this morning in our studio, 10. John Kenny, you were impressed by this, and you're playing all the instruments yourself. You're playing the keyboard, you're playing the guitar.
Yeah.
You're fascinated by that, John.
Well, I am absolutely fascinated by anyone who can play music, and I'd fair play, like, as thanks to God, this is, drummers are, you know, the best, some of the best musicians in the world are drummers, because we've heard so many drummer jokes, Paul.
Yeah,
you,
yeah.
I mean, musicians do it all the time.
Yeah.
It's like accordion players get it too, but
so what are you
magic.
Going to play us out on?
I'm gonna do a song called Some Surprise, and
okay.
I wrote this for my wife Amy.
Oh.
And I played it at our wedding day and I made a bit of a balls of it that day. So hopefully
I just want to say and announce our winner of today's competition, which is going to see the Arctic Concert Orchestra celebrating 40 years of The Wall and the band Visions of Floyd. The winner is Catherine Cook from Dunmore Road in Waterford. Congrats, Catherine. My thanks and sound today to Dave Gibson, Denise Davies, our BCO, Shanna Gorman, produced. Thanks so much, John Kenny, to you.
Thank
Paul
you.
Noonan, thank you so much for coming in and take us out with your beautiful song for your wife, Amy.
Your lips come as some surprise that they would want to come and meet mine. They never taste like the last time. Your lips come as some surprise. I was always a special child. The circuit boards for my insides. And all I dreamed of was flying high. So your lips came as some surprise. Your lips come as some surprise. That they would wanna come and meet mine. And they never taste like the last time. Your lips come with some surprise. No, I was never one of the boys throwing shapes and them power ploys. In your arms a warm I did find, and in your seat I did recline. Yeah, your lips come with some surprise, but they would wanna come and meet mine, and they never taste like the last time. Your lips come with some surprise. Oh, now that we've sat for a while, you showed me yours and I've shown you mine. Even after all this time, your lips come with some surprise. Your lips come with some surprise. But they would wanna come and meet mine, and they never taste like the last time. Your lips come with some surprise. Your lips come with some surprise. Yeah, your lips come with some surprise.